Today at Radio Veloren, we are once again speaking to one of your local politicians. And I'm welcoming once again to the show Shadow Home Affairs Minister, Whip, and Labour MP Bambos Charalambos to get the answers to your questions. And remember, if you've not been lucky to get answers from Bambos this time, he will be back again, not next month, but the month after, because of rules of Purdah next month. But we, you know, with these discussions, I do try to have positives. I do try to be fair with some negatives as well. But we're going to start off here. And one of the positives since we had our conversation was Mother's Day. Were you able to celebrate this? Were you able to kind of engage in Mother's Day, Bambos?
Yes, I was. So my parents are in my support bubble. So I got my mum a card and some flowers and some various bits and pieces like hand creams and that sort of stuff. So yeah, I was able to like spend a few hours with my parents, and yeah, she was very happy and cheered, and she'll be even happier when she gets her second jab, which will be happening next month. So yeah, I think she's very much looking forward to that.
Well, that is fantastic to hear that you're obviously able to see her, but also in terms of her health as well, getting that jab. Now, also this month, we have seen International Women's Day. Usually, it's a celebration of all the accomplishments of females around the world. And it's also time as well to highlight the injustices and unfairness that women sometimes experience in day-to-day life. First of all, Bambos, what did you do for International Women's Day?
Well, on the actual date itself, I was in the Commons speaking on the third day of the budget debate. But I mean, we shouldn't just have one day for women. We should like be campaigning and supporting women throughout the whole year. There are huge inequalities, and there are issues around the power that men have that disproportionately impacts on women. I think one of the shocking stats is that there are 3 women killed every week in the UK. And it's, you know, so much more needs to be done. I think we need to campaign to make sure we do get equality, that women are paid the same as men, that they're not discriminated against, that they feel safe. And also we should encourage women to put themselves forward for standing for election, for instance, look at areas where there are huge gaps in representation, particularly at top level management, on boards as directors. Those are all sorts of things we should still be doing throughout the year. And I'm very much keen to give my support to that. I encouraged a young woman I know to stand as a candidate in a local election. So hopefully she'll do well in those elections when they happen.
And on this discussion point of changing society, usually people look at maybe books or certain documentaries or just projects that kind of do change things and help people learn. Because I think one of the best ways to have change is for people to learn how to improve. So are there any specific authors, projects that you'd like to highlight in regards to women's progress as well, Bambos?
Well, there's a project called Ask Her to Stand. So I think it's trying to encourage more women to put themselves forward, to stand for election, to get that experience. So I think certainly stuff that the Fawcett Society are doing is excellent. There's many other organisations that, that do that work, but particularly the Fawcett Society are a really good example about the progressive work that they're doing in this area. On authors, there are some amazing female authors. The one that I've read recently is Bernardine Evaristo. She had a book, I think it was out last year, called Girl, Woman, Other. So I think that I highly recommend that, because that gives you, it's very insightful, and it's told through the eyes of different generations. It gives you some insight into a particular mindset from a woman's perspective.
And moving on to the other discussions this month. And even though, as mentioned, it was supposed to be International Women's Day, a celebration, but also highlighting some of the problems. And we were very much reminded of the unfairness, inequality and struggles that women have in day-to-day life doing basic tasks that men take for granted. It was the tragic death of Sarah Everard. Bambos, what are your feelings on the response from the government on this issue?
Well, I think it was, I think it took the government by surprise. There was an outcry for more to be done to actually protect women and girls from violence. So the government did pledge more money for domestic abuse and for various other measures, but it was seen as being too little too late. And certainly women I was in contact with were saying they feel very unsafe. They feel that there's still a big problem with sexual harassment and abuse that they face. And it's really sad because as a man, I don't feel that way, but clearly it's an issue that affects all of us and we all need to take action to make sure that women feel safe. I also think the policing of the Clapham Common vigil was really badly handled as well. And I think the government should have done a lot more to step in there. They could have just said, yeah, we'll just let this go ahead. A peaceful vigil should have been allowed to proceed.
And in the aftermath, do you believe that the government are listening? Because almost straight after, there was proposals for ununiformed officers to be in bars and clubs, which a lot of women said is not helping the problem. And then Harriet Hartman actually kind of called for a cross-party unity to push something through that would actually help women in terms of it coming from women in the know as well. So are they actually listening to people like Harriet Hartman, or are they pushing on without getting information from people who actually know what they're talking about?
Well, I think this was a knee-jerk reaction to the crisis that was all over the papers. So I think they just wanted to get something out there. I think what they should do, or what they should have done, was agree to with cool heads to look at what the nature of the problem is and take action to address what the problem is. So that is listening to people like Harriet Harman, to Caroline Noakes, who's the Conservative chair of the Equalities Committee in Parliament, and to various other people who've got a long experience. My colleague Jess Phillips, who's got long experience in working in areas of domestic abuse. Before she was an MP, she ran a refuge. So I think there are things that I think the government needs to do more, and they need to start listening, because that's the only way you can actually solve a problem, by actually listening to the people that have the insight and the know-how. And lots of other organisations like Women's Aid, who do amazing work. And there's also Plan. They're doing a project with a group called Our Streets Now about the harassment that women and girls face. I think they want to pass legislation to outlaw that harassment that even schoolgirls face on the way to and from school.
It is dreadful to hear. And the whole point of us here at Radio Verulam, the show that I do, is to help people in the community. And Bambos, for those who might be feeling unsafe or under threat in Enfield Southgate area, what kind of advice can you give, and who can they turn to for help?
Well, first of all, if it's a criminal matter, so if they're experiencing something that they regard as criminal, they should report it straight away to the police. So they should ring 999 or else the 101 number to make sure that, that it's been reported. If it's there's also a number of organisations. If it's a child who's experiencing the problem, then they should contact the NSPCC. You've got a very good helpline. Enfield Council actually run a hub where you can actually contact the council to report any abuse or harassment. And the council have contacts with a number of agencies that they can assist with this. So there are areas that can be done, but the most important thing is to report it. And also, even if you don't feel comfortable reporting it to an agency, reporting it to somebody you can trust who might be able to help report it for you would be another way forward.
So let's move the discussions on to what you've been doing in the House of Parliament. You've been trying to help constituent matters, but also in British matters as a whole. And this month you presented a petition to Parliament on the 24-hour gambling licence granted in Green Lanes. However, the company itself, McCurr, followed procedure. Why do you feel, and why do many residents feel, that this place should not have been allowed?
Well, first of all, the application was made during the coronavirus lockdown. So in December, they posted a notice outside the empty premises, which was what they were lawfully required to do. But because people were obeying lockdown rules, they were only allowed to go out to go shopping or to get their daily exercise. So there were serious restrictions. So people wouldn't have been aware. In fact, they weren't aware of the application. And one of the other requirements is for it to be advertised in a local newspaper. Well, it's one of the sad things that we don't receive local newspapers anymore. It's a sad state of affairs that we've seen a decline in the print newspaper industry. So, but these are requirements under the Gambling Act. So these are, so by advertising in the nearest local paper, which I think was an Essex paper, and by putting this flimsy notice outside the premises, they've complied with the requirements, and yet it wasn't brought to anybody's attention. So nobody could raise any objections. So that, to me, sounded incredibly unfair and unjust, and that's why I raised the issue. And many people were very angry about this in my constituents. They felt that they, you know, this had been, you know, got away with, if you like.
And what is the progress so far on this? You've presented it to Parliament. What kind of steps can people expect to happen from now on?
Well, following my presentation of the petitions, I'm trying to think what the name is. So the people that run the petitions in Parliament, they then refer it to the appropriate department. So it's gone to the petition's gone to the DCMS now. So they will then respond to my particular, to the concerns on the petition. But separate from that, there's a Gambling Act review. And that review talks about a whole series of different areas in relation to the Gambling Act provisions. So I've contacted a number of my constituents and asked them to contact the, or to take part in the consultation, which ends on the 31st of March. And to make sure that their views are heard about this anomaly in publicising an application for a licence.
So is the end goal for you, yourself, but also for constituents to not have the McCurr gambling premises, or is it for them to change something about the way that they operate, maybe not to be 24 hours, but maybe to only be during the day? Is that the main problem with it?
Well, a preference would be not to have them there at all, because I don't think that slot machines and gambling are particularly helpful in a local area, particularly when you want to try and revive the area. I think the 24-hour licence, I think it would be good to try and meet with Merca to find out what their intentions are. I think the 24-hour licence comes with the particular machines that they're going to have installed on the premises, so you automatically get 24 hours, but then it's for them whether they wish to operate for 24 hours or not. But at the moment, we have no idea as to what their intentions are. So, but potentially they could operate 24/7, and that would be of great concern to local residents.
So, just maybe a little time frame then, Bambos, for those listening. When can people expect a result, if you will, that something is going to change?
Well, Merca have got their license, so they've already secured a license. However, some local residents had a meeting with myself, local councillors, and officers from Enfield Council. So I think there's still potential for them to submit a review. So I think the review can happen any time now. So I know local residents are going through the details of the application and just seeing which areas they can object to for purposes of the review. So that's the first thing. The consultation finishes on the 31st of March. This is the DCMS one. And again, I don't know when the DCMS will report on that. I imagine they'll have received a substantial number of emails and correspondence in relation to the review. So I imagine that will be later on in the year. So those are the two sort of milestones in relation to that.
So let's move our attention to something else that you've been involved in Parliament. You were the teller for the support of Nusgani's changes to the trade bill. You said it's shocking that the Tory government voted against the bill to restrict trade with countries who commit genocide. This is also after the fact that the government has pushed on to trade with Saudi Arabia, but America has actually cut a lot of ties with the country. Will the government be able to be persuaded to only deal with countries that morally align with the UK, or has it gone too far now?
I think it's gone too far. I think the governments have just paid lip service to human rights abuses. They cherry pick the countries they want to trade with. And clearly they see that China is a big potential market for the UK, and that overrides anything to do with human rights. It's a sad state of affairs that's the way we are, but that's the choice of the UK government. I know that they came out and said that they're going to take some Magnitsky sanctions against four Chinese officials, but that's too little. It's not nowhere near enough, whereas trade would actually really hurt China. So, and particularly when you hear about the you know, what's being done to the Uyghur Muslims in China. So I think there's serious concern that the UK is turning a blind eye to the human rights abuses to China for the benefit of trade.
Some conservatives and some people who are pro this decision actually have the argument that if you trade with these people, then they're more likely to come to the table and do a deal on this certain, you know, set of ideologies and maybe morally align. This is something that actually Donald Trump attempted to do with China. He kind of put trade on the line for certain sanctions, certain discussion points. Do you believe in that sort of argument, or do you believe that Britain needs to take a strong moral stance and say, no, we're not trading with you until you change?
Well, it's nice in theory, but I'd like to see the examples of where that has brought about change. So if they can give me some real examples, I'm going to consider it. But personally, I don't believe that's the way it works. I don't think it's... I think once they have the trade, it's very hard for them to break it off, because then that would have an impact on UK businesses then. So I think so then they're already sucked in, and it's harder to break that relationship.
Moving the attention to something closer to home, more kind of conduct under question. This time it is the Prime Minister himself. He's come under a lot of scrutiny this month, failing to apologise or make a correction that he made over an incorrect statement he made about your party leader, Sir Keir Starmer. Does the fact that the Prime Minister, Mr Boris Johnson, the fact that he has refused to apologise and goes unpunished show that the UK Parliament is in need of tougher rules for the 21st century that are fit for purpose?
Well, I think that's a very good point. I think it's, I mean, we're all meant to refer to each other as honourable members, and clearly not apologising for saying something that isn't true is not the actions of somebody who's honourable. So I think it cheapens Parliament when people refuse to apologise or retract something that's clearly incorrect. And it doesn't serve our democracy well at all if that happens. So I certainly think that there should be some, you know, tougher requirements to make sure that that MPs who, to be fair, some MPs do apologise if they've got something wrong, but refusing to apologise by the Prime Minister is not a good example to lead to other people.
What rule changes would you like to see then? Because obviously we're talking here about the need for maybe a change within Parliament, how Parliament is run. What could be rules to basically punish an individual if they do not tell the truth, do not change the record?
Well, ultimately the Speaker is the one who controls what goes on in the chamber. So the Speaker has the ultimate sanction of banning somebody from the House. So I've seen people banned for refusing to comply with the Speaker's request. So, you know, there might be powers that are already there. But I'd have to thumb through Erskine May and see what's appropriate there. So if I get a chance over East, I might just do that.
Let's turn the attention to your party, though, Bambos. I've done some research here, and the most recent Ipsos Mori polling shows that amongst Labour voters, Sir Keir Starmer's approval rating has gone from 66% to 19% since October to now. In the eyes of your voters, what have Labour been doing wrong?
Well, I think opinion polls are always going to be, you know, go with whatever the weather is. But I do think the government have received a big bounce because of the vaccine program being rolled out. So I think with the, the Tories that are riding high on that bounce at the moment, even though it's being delivered by the NHS and by GP surgeries. So I think that that's partly why, because I think people are grateful to be, you know, have an end in sight for COVID. So I think that's partly what's benefited the government and conversely adversely impacted Labour and also, you know, the respective leaders of both parties. So I think that's one thing that's an issue. Also, it's much harder if you're, it's hard enough being the leader of the opposition, but being the leader under lockdown and being the leader when you have to operate virtually is also really hard. And you'll probably find that the fortunes have ebbed and flowed with how well or badly the Tories have been doing in dealing with COVID and the coronavirus crisis. So I do think we need to take these figures with a pinch of salt. And I think once things, hopefully the 21st of June, will come around quickly and we're all back to some sort of normality then. And I think then you'll, and when coronavirus isn't so much of an issue, I think then you'll see what the two parties, what their real differences are. You won't have the backdrop of coronavirus then you'll see what difference the Labour Party and Keir will be making.
Just on the discussion point about the COVID bounce or the COVID vaccine bounce, though, this has been a continual, you know, drop off since October. So the October to, let's say, January time would not encapsulate the effect of the vaccine. And a lot of people are discussing about how this is a prime time for Labour to show their opposition to the government. But quite often, and we will get onto this in a moment as well when we talk about the Police and Crimes Bill, but the Labour position has been not to oppose, but to actually not vote on a lot of issues. Do you think that people are kind of worried seeing that position there, that Labour is not actually being in opposition, but kind of allowing some of these things to just go through unopposed?
Well, there are plenty of things that we have opposed. So we opposed the Immigration and Social Security Bill. We opposed the Overseas Operations Bill. There are many things that we do oppose. We voted against the Police and Crimes Bill, the Police Crime Courts, Sentencing and Courts Bill, second reading. So there are many things we have opposed. So I think that's a bit of an unfair criticism. I think also people that don't always understand the parliamentary procedure, the stages of different bills. So the second reading, you tend to not oppose it because you're not opposing the principle of the bill, but you might oppose it at third reading when you get into the actual, the nitty-gritty of the detail. So I think that's, I think there is a nuance there, which many people don't. So I was watching some comments on the police crime sentencing courts bill. People were saying is that it then? And it's like, well, no, there are, you know, still many more stages to the bill there. So I think it's partly that sort of not quite appreciating what stages there are to the bill that also causes problems.
Let's talk about the police and crimes bill then, because that has caused a lot of discussion. A lot of people are worried that it's going to impede their ability to peacefully protest, because the wording is that if you cause disruption, then you might be arrested. In fact, you might be put away for 10 years. But the voice of Labour this week was of how bad the bill was. However, it is a change in tone, where previously the party was going to be whipped into no voting. Why was there a change in position over the course of the week?
Well, I think it's always helpful to have a discussion about the position. And I think if you read the bill, and it's quite a lengthy bill, it's 307 pages. So there's lots of stuff in. I think there are some aspects of the bill that I think we'd have no problem with agreeing with. I think things like the something about problem courts. So these are courts that deal with a particular issue like an addiction or some other sort of issue that might arise. So these are things that we would quite happily support. But the problem is it's all bundled up, and it has these other measures that are hugely controversial, that are wedge issues, that have been put there primarily to make sure that there is opposition to the bill. And, you know, people would say, well, why are you voting for a bill that has longer sentences for child murderers? So it's like, well, we don't oppose that. We oppose this part of the bill, which is about the right to protest, which is about the gypsy traveller encampments, which is about the 10 years for statues. So it's so on one level, and it's put there quite deliberately by the Tories because they know it's a wedge issue. So they can say to their voters, Labour is soft on crime by voting against the bill. So I think on reflection, we were never going to support it, but certainly it was a choice whether we would oppose it or abstain. And I think it's healthy to have discussions with colleagues to see what their views of it is. And I think that's only a democratic process that you can only reach once you have those discussions. And I think opposing it was the right decision to reach at the end of the day, because losing these fundamental rights, the right to protest and the impact it has on the gypsy traveller community and also the 10 years for statues does strike me as quite odd.
And just on this area of protestation, obviously the bill has passed its second reading now. Can you explain to people how this might not be the end of the trail, though, that this area of conflict that a lot of people are worried about might still be removed?
Yeah, so a bill has a number of stages. So the next stage of the bill will be to go to a committee. I'll be on that committee. So the committee will spend, they'll have 20 sessions. They'll hear evidence from different groups, and they'll then go through the bill line by line with amendments being tabled. Once it goes out of committee, it goes to the Commons again for the report stage, which deals with any amendments that have been tabled. Further amendments can be tabled at that stage and voted on. So amendments can be tabled throughout this whole process. And then after those amendments have been voted on, then you go through to the third reading. And if it passes that, it then goes off to the Lords. So there's still a number of stages, and those stages will happen in the summer months and in the autumn. So there's still plenty of stages for this bill to go. So we're only just at the beginning of the stages for the bill. And there's plenty of opportunity for people to, for the bill to be amended, for things to be removed, for things to be altered. So there's still all to play for.
Let's move it on to the final pre-community question from myself. And it's a sobering thought that it's about a year now since the country went into its first lockdown that we started to realise the full scale of COVID-19's impact. Although, to be fair, we still don't know how long this impact is going to be, the long COVID effect on Britain. What are your reflections of a year dealing with COVID in Enfield and Southgate?
Well, the first reflection is just about how wonderful the community was in coming together, in supporting their neighbours, in delivering food parcels. Also the support for our amazing frontline workers, you know, the NHS workers, the bus drivers, the people who were working in public sector. So that whole community spirit was Britain at its best. But also the sadness that so many people lost their lives and the lost opportunities to actually try and save those lives in relation to not locking down sooner. That's also a very sad reflection that I have. But for me, the fact that people were able to pull together and that brought out the best in people certainly is one of the memories that I will have of the pandemic period. And there are still lots of things that still need to be done. So even we're not out of the woods yet, there's still issues around children's education. There's still issues around businesses getting back to normal and people seeing loved ones. The sadness of people not being able to visit their loved ones in care homes, the shocking number of people who died in our care homes, you know, is truly heartbreaking. And those are issues that certainly need to be addressed. And I hope we do have a public inquiry very soon, and that we reflect on what could have been done better, and we make sure that those mistakes never happen again.
And the thing is as well, what I like to highlight with this kind of discussion point here, Bambos, is that the work of MPs like yourself, you've done a lot behind the scenes that maybe people don't even realise. I talk with Daisy Cooper and Bim Afolami as well each month, and even though they might be the opposition in one sense, you're all working for your local constituents. And so I'd just like to highlight the amazing work that you've done yourself behind the scenes here with your team working on cases, because quite often, isn't it, Bambos, that it's little kind of things that you do to help people in a big way.
Absolutely. You know, just helping people get their grants. I mean, earlier last year, I was volunteering to help deliver food parcels to people. Supporting local charities. There's an amazing group I've mentioned before called Cooking Champions, who deliver cooked meals to people. They're wonderful. I can't praise them enough. You know, there was at one stage there was a choir that I came across that did some. You know, they were absolutely wonderful. People were socially distanced in a park singing, and that certainly helped with people's mental health and how they were feeling about themselves. So yeah, it's good to support all these organisations. I'm very proud to be the MP for Enfield Southgate, and it's really impressive to see the wonderful community groups and people who are just selfless in what they give to improve the lot of people locally.
One final point that I did put to Bim Afolami was I mentioned Albert Camus, and I think two of his works are very kind of poignant at the moment. We've got The Myth of Sisyphus and The Plague. And one of the lines from The Myth of Sisyphus that stands out is that at times of crisis, lucid reasoning, knowing its limits is what is needed. So kind of understanding that we are human, that in times of crisis, we don't sometimes know exactly what to do. And I kind of link that to the point that a lot of people are very critical of the government. And so I don't know, just the first discussion point there, Bambos, is do you believe that people have been too critical or not critical enough? And the second point is with the plague, the kind of overall story of the allegory is that it's the importance of decency. And do you believe that the Conservative government and your own party as well have shown decency throughout this? So just those two discussion points.
I think obviously this virus, this pandemic was, it's totally unexpected. It's one of these things that is nobody's had to deal with. It's one of those things that has just been forced upon us that people have had to respond to. And I think, to be fair, I think the way that the government and the opposition have dealt with it has been in a spirit of cordiality and dealt with it in a very understanding and collaborative manner. So I do think that we've worked together for the benefit of the country. And that's obviously a good thing, because you don't want to, I think we would never be forgiven if we were point scoring on the issue about making sure that people were safe, that people were protected, and the vaccine was rolled out properly. But clearly there'll be issues where we are critical of the government, so certainly about some of the contracts that were awarded. And that's what we, should do as an opposition. But generally, I think the way we've worked collaboratively to try and, deal with this unprecedented event has been quite positive. And again, that goes back to what I was saying about seeing, the best in people. And I think you'll find that most people would give the government of the day, whichever party they were from, whoever had to deal with the crisis, would have given them benefit of the doubt, because they understand that it's unprecedented and they want to find a solution. They know that you'd only get that by working together. So I think that's what I would take from that.
So on to the community questions. And last month we talked about an issue, and I just wanted to kind of have this topic of democracy in action by asking you these questions. Things do happen. Has there been any progress on the changing of the local council's position on the Dugdale Centre? Were you able to find any information about whether it will change its usage after COVID, or have the kind of council changed on that position now?
I'm not aware of any change so far, but again, I mean, we'll know after lockdown is over. Currently, it's been used as a vaccination centre. So I do think once it's stopped being used for that purpose, and that might well be well into the summer, the council might then review what it plans to do with the Dugdale Centre. But until then, I think it's too early to say.
So Talia has sent in a message about the government's amendment to the bill that protects the employment rights of pregnant people. Talia was quite worried for the fact that it removes protection for those who are transgender. And so the previous bill had a gender-neutral language to it, but when it reached the House of Lords, the gender-neutral nature of the language was removed for only pregnant cisgender women, it seems to be. So, Bambos, do you think that you would like to step in and intervene on what Talia has described as a discriminatory act of legislation?
Well, I know there was a fair bit of debate about this when the bill was in the Commons. I mean, this is primarily to allow a cabinet minister to be on maternity leave, to have paid maternity leave. So I think clearly trying to get away from, we need to understand what the bill was actually about in the first place. I do think that in the issue about trans rights, I do think that this isn't like the biggest issue that trans people face. And I do think that there's a lot of focus on something which, my preference would have been for it to be neutral language, but I don't think it necessarily matters so much for this particular bill. But I do think we need to look at trans rights in greater detail, because I think that trans people are discriminated against, and that they face huge aspects of discrimination and what's the word, you know, judgment from people in other quarters that disproportionately affects them. And I think that needs to be looked at in greater detail.
I think the main problem that a lot of people have is the fact that the language before was actually gender neutral, and it was almost gone out of the way, is what has been described and sent to me, is that it was then changed to woman. So would you like to see in all kind of future legislation that a gender neutral term of people rather than a specific gender be used?
Well, in the past, you know, all bills used to refer to men. So it was all about, you know, if a man does this, if a man does that. Well, I think that, you know, that language was changed. So I do think we should approach things in a more gender neutral tone. I think that's only right and proper.
Moving on to a local issue. And Michael says, what can be done about the rise of thieves stealing catalytic converters? How can I protect my vehicle?
It's a huge problem, and it has been a problem that's been going on for a number of years. There are gangs who are actually very quick at going underneath the car and just cutting out. What they actually want to do is get hold of the titanium that's in the catalytic converter, because that's a very precious metal. Unfortunately, it's an issue that needs to be designed out by the manufacturers. So I think that is the long-term solution to this. But what I would say is that people need to be vigilant. They should sort of, if they haven't got one, establish a local neighborhood watch and make sure that people are looking out and sharing information with their, if they've got a street WhatsApp group, just telling people what's been going on. In my street, we had a spate of blue badge thefts. One of the local residents was able to take a picture out of his window of the person who he saw walking away. But unfortunately, it was only the back of that person, not the front. But even though that's helpful to just have an idea as to who to look out for. So certainly more community community action in relation to being vigilant. But ultimately, it's going to be a decision that's going to be that needs to be implemented by the in the design of the vehicles to make sure that catalytic converters are not so easy to access in the future.
Sean has re-brought up what we've been discussing about a little bit earlier with women's protection. She has said, with the recent death of Sarah Everard, I think this once again brings to the fore the argument about how low traffic neighbourhoods negatively impact women's safety. Bambos, can you please protect the women of our area and make sure that these are removed?
Well, first of all, I don't accept that premise. I think it's not LTNs that make women feel less safe. It's men who make women feel less safe. And unless we address men's behaviour, and unless that changes and changes for the long term, then no matter what road structure you have, women are going to feel less safe. As I mentioned earlier, girls get harassed on the way to and from school. You know, women get harassed in all sorts of situations which don't necessarily involve being in a particular road or not. So I do think that addressing men's behaviour and empowering women is the key to this, not necessarily a particular design of a road layout.
Do you not believe, though, that it would be logical that until men's behaviour changes, that society actually does that progress that you're discussing about? That's more of a utopian thing, whereas changing the LTN back to how it once was so that women can be dropped by cabs to their doors, that would be the more sensible thing in the short term.
Well, I think women were still being attacked before LTNs. It's not as if there weren't any crimes going on before LTNs were introduced. So there were. So I don't accept the premise of that. And also, I mean, one thing that you might find is that LTNs bring out more people. So I think if LTNs are there, you may find there are more people out and about in the streets, which might make it safer.
So let's move on to Shane's question here, and he's asked, This is the sixth year in a row of tax increases in Enfield. Why are we paying more for less of a service? Bambos, what are your thoughts and feelings on that one?
Well, the real answer is that it's because the government have cut Enfield's funding over the last 10 years. This is the 11th year we've had of austerity, and all councils' budgets have been cut and cut and cut. It's no accident that you've seen a number of councils that have been on the brink of bankruptcy. Tory Bexley Council had to be bailed out. You've had problems with Croydon Council needing to be helped out because they've they're basically sort of facing deep financial problems. And a number of other councils, I think Peterborough is another one. And we've seen Northampton Council go bust. This is no accident that this is happening, and it's happening because after 10 years of austerity, 11 years of austerity now, councils don't have any other way of raising revenue, because whatever they raise is capped by the government through council tax, but whatever they raise won't replace the tens of millions pounds that the government have cut from their budgets over the number of years. And that's why we, you know, have very, most boroughs don't have youth services. Most boroughs now are only able to afford statutory services and very little else, which is a real shame. And much more needs to be done by the government to invest in local authorities.
So to end, Nicola has asked this question to all the MPs, and I think this is a nice one to end on. Bambos, on the 26th of April, things at the moment are looking to open again because of the data, although that may change. But are you excited for things to open again? And what will be the first thing that you do?
Well, I would be very excited for things to go back to some sense of normality. One thing I'm desperate to have is a haircut. At the moment, I feel like I'm in a 1980s band. I think I'm at the back, I've got like a bit of a mullet going on there. But so yes, I'm desperate to try and get a haircut. That's the top priority for me. I feel very hairy at the moment.
I mean, I do have to ask, because my gran has been my barber during lockdown. Who has had the privilege of cutting your hair, Bambos?
Well, literally around the corner from where I live, there's two guys in a barbershop next to the station. So I just go there, and I think it's about 12 quid for a haircut. So that's a bargain price. Thankfully, I don't have too much done to my hair, as you can probably tell.
But I mean, during this lockdown period, has it been your wife or another family member that's helped you manage your hair? Or has it just been between trips, it's been a long old time, and that you've let it grow long like this?
Just let it grow, because I don't trust anyone else to cut my hair who's not professionally trained. I think obviously if you're an MP and you have to appear in public, then you do take a risk by letting other people try and cut your hair or doing it yourself.
Well, that is a positive one to end on, Bambos. I'm looking forward to when we talk next to seeing what fresh haircut you do have. But as always, I do thank you for your time. And once again, you might miss Bambos next month because he won't be on the airwaves, but he will be returning very, very soon. But yes, thank you, Bambos.
Thanks, Jason.